But the young soldier just shrugged as if to say, yeah, somebody is shooting, so what? Driscoll's truck turned west on the Boyamaran Shah Road, and it headed along steep cliffs, made twists and turns, and climbed with a rumble in the engine that let the American operator know that the vehicle was straining under the effort. Finally, just after 7 in the morning, the truck turned off the road, climbed a steep, rocky path that led to a compound on a flat table on a steep hillside, and then pulled through the open front gate. Two of the other trucks were already there, parked in a two-car garage facing the main gate. Al-Darkur, two captains, and one of the two squads of security got together in the dusty courtyard and began speaking animatedly in Urdu. Driscoll had no idea what the problem was until Muhammad himself stepped over to him. The other truck did not make it. They were hit in the center of town. One of my captains has been shot in the wrist, and a soldier was hit in the stomach. They made it back to the base, but they do not think the soldier will survive.
I'm sorry.
Al-Darkur patted Driscoll on the shoulder. We made it, though. Congratulations. Before, I was only going to let you sit and watch while we did the work. But now, I need you to help.
Just tell me what you need.
We will set up surveillance on the road. The camp is just 3 kilometers farther west, and everyone who goes there from the airport or the city of Maran Shah must pass on the road below us. The 6 soldiers joined with 6 men who were already there at the compound and formed into a low-profile security cordon, while Al-Darkur, Driscoll, and the 2 ISI captains used a window in a second-story hallway as an observation point. They set up a pair of long-range cameras and pulled mattresses off beds in other rooms so that they could keep up the surveillance with minimal breaks. Al-Darkur had one of his captains bring a large trunk into the hallway, and he set it down near Driscoll's mattress. Mr. Sam, Al-Darkur said in his sing-song Pakistani accent, am I correct in assuming you had a military career before the CIA?
I was in the army, yes.
Special forces, perhaps?
Perhaps.
Al-Darkur smiled. Even though you are my guest, I would feel better if you outfitted yourself in the gear my captain has here for you. Driscoll looked in the trunk and found an American M4 rifle with a 3.5 power Trijicon ACOG scope, an original special operations equipment chest harness with Kevlar and steel armor, and 8 extra magazines for the rifle, a helmet, and a utility belt with a Glock 9mm pistol and extra magazines. He looked up at the major with a wink.
I would feel better, too.
Driscoll suited up. It felt good to carry what was essentially the same rig he used in the Rangers. Once outfitted with the fighting gear, he looked up to Al-Darkur and gave him the thumbs up. Al-Darkur said, now we drink tea and we wait. 35. The Sunday after the debate, Benton Thayer walked alone through the parking lot of the Chevy Chase Club, one of the oldest and finest country clubs in the greater D.C. area. Even though it was not yet noon, and he was decked out for a day at the links in Hollis large plaid pants and knits and a purposefully clashing Ian Poulter tartan flat cap, Benton had just left the rest of his foursome after only 9 holes. With the last debate out of the way, he'd taken the first half of his Sunday off for some time outside on this crisp fall day. But he needed to get back to the city and back to work. As President Edward Kielty's campaign manager, he would have to wait until after November 6th for some R&R. And as Benton headed for his white Lexus SUV, he told himself he'd likely have a lot of free time after November 6th. Not just because the election would be over, but because his man would lose, which meant his government sector prospects in D.C. would be zilch, and his private sector opportunities around here would be tinged by his failure to retain the Oval Office for his boss. No self-respecting campaign manager throws in the towel publicly with 3 weeks until Election Day, and Thayer had 5 radio spots and 9 television interviews planned for Monday, when he would confidently declare just the opposite of what he knew to be true. But the 43-year-old walking alone in the parking lot was no idiot. Short of Jack Ryan being caught with his pants around his ankles outside a daycare, the writing was on the wall, and the election was over. Still, he considered himself a good soldier, and there were the media appearances in the morning that he needed to prepare for, so he was off to work. As he climbed into his Lexus, he noticed a small manila envelope tucked under his windshield wiper. He leaned out, grabbed the package, and sat back in the car. Thinking that someone who belonged to the club must have left this for him, the grounds were fenced and guarded, after all, he tore into the bag without a thought. Inside, there was no note, no indication of who had left the package. But what he did find was a small thumb drive. If he had been anywhere else, at the mall, in his driveway, Returning to his car from his office at campaign headquarters, Benton Thayer would have taken an unknown and unsolicited package like this and tossed it in the street. But this was different. He decided to give it a look when he got to work. 2 hours later, Thayer had switched into khakis, an open-collared dress shirt, a wrinkle-free navy blue blazer, and loafers, no socks, and he sat at his desk in his office. The thumb drive had been forgotten for a bit, but he held it now, turned it back and forth, looking for any clue as to who had passed it. After another moment's hesitation, he sat up and began to connect the drive to his laptop, but he stopped himself, hesitating again. He worried about the mysterious drive containing a virus that could either damage his machine or somehow steal the data from it. Seconds later, Thayer stepped into the large open loft that served as the war room of the Washington campaign office. Around him, dozens of men and women manned computers, phones, printers, and fax machines. A buzz of activity, fueled by a long row of coffee urns on cloth-covered tables against the wall to his left. There, at the closest table, a college-aged girl was filling her eco-friendly travel mug with hot coffee. Thayer didn't know the girl. He didn't bother to learn the names of more than the top 5% of his staff. "You," he said with a point of his finger. The young lady jolted when she realized he was talking to her. Coffee splashed out of her mug. "Yes, sir," she replied nervously. "You have a laptop?" She nodded. "At my desk." "Get it. Bring it in here." He disappeared back into his office, and the college girl scurried to do as she was told. The third of the room that was in earshot of the exchange stopped working and stared, watched the woman grab her Mac and rush back toward Thayer's office as if they were regarding a condemned criminal on the way to the gallows. Benton Thayer did not ask the girl her name or what she did. Instead, he instructed her to put the thumb drive into her MacBook Pro and open the folder. She did this with slightly quivering fingers that were still sticky with spilled sugary coffee. As the single folder opened, revealing several files, Thayer told her to wait outside. The young lady was all too happy to oblige. Satisfied now that his own machine would not be damaged by a corrupt thumb drive, Benton Thayer began going through the files that had been surreptitiously delivered to him. There was no explanation, no electronic version of a cover sheet, but the file was titled John Clark. Thayer knew a couple of guys named John Clark. It was a common name. But when he opened the file and saw a series of photos, he realized he did not know this man. Then he began clicking through pages and pages of data on the man. A dossier of sorts. A personal history. U.S. Navy SEAL team. Military Assistance Command, Vietnam, Studies and Observations Group. Thayer had no idea what that was, but it sounded shady as hell to him. Then, CIA. Special Activities Division. Targeted killings. Sanction denied operations. Thayer shrugged. Okay, this guy's a spook. And a spooky spook. But why should I care? Then specific operations were laid out. He thumbed through them quickly. He could tell these were not CIA documents, but they seemed to contain detailed information about Clark's agency career. It was a complicated mess of information. Information that might be interesting to someone. Human Rights Watch? Amnesty International? But Benton Thayer? He was growing bored looking through it. He carried on an internal dialogue with the mysterious person who delivered him this thumb drive. Jesus, like I give a shit. Get to the point. Then he stopped. Huh? Is this the point? Photos with Clark and a younger John Patrick Ryan. Details of their relationship spanning a quarter century. So the guy is old, and he's ex-CIA. Ryan is old and ex-CIA. They knew each other? That's all you've got, mystery man? And then, after a rundown of John Clark's years in Rainbow, a single document that seemed to be out of place. An allegation of a murder Clark committed in Germany 30 years ago. Why isn't this in its place in the timeline? Thayer read it carefully. From all the information present, he got the impression that this intel was coming from a source outside of the United States. He flipped to the next page. A document detailing a presidential pardon given in secret to Clark for assassinations carried out at CIA. So, Thayer muttered to himself. CIA Chief Ryan orders Clark to kill people, then President Ryan papers over the crimes after the fact. Holy shit. Thayer picked up the phone, pushed a pair of buttons. It's Thayer. I need to see him tonight, just as soon as he gets out of Marine One and back into the White House. 36. Traffic on the Boyamiranshah Road had been light throughout the day, and it turned near non-existent at night. Some transport vehicles, Taliban on motorcycles, and a few brightly colored buses with small mirrors hanging from the sides like Christmas ornaments. But the men in the observation post saw nothing that seemed at all out of the ordinary. Mohammed al-Darkour said that his prisoner had mentioned that ISI officers were coming into the area via aircraft, which meant they had to land at Miranshah, and they had to travel this road to get to the camp. But in the first 36 hours of the surveillance, Driscoll and the others had come up empty. Still, al-Darkour photographed each and every vehicle that passed. He had no way to be certain some high-ranking ISI officer, even General Riaz Rian himself, would not dress himself up like a goat herder to make his way to the Haqqani training camps. So after each vehicle passed their position, al-Darkour and his men reviewed the high-res images. But so far, they had seen no indication that the ISI, or even some foreign force for that matter, was operating in the area. Just after midnight, Driscoll was manning a night vision camera on a tripod facing down to the road, while the other three men lay on their cots in the hallway behind him. A jingle bus had passed a minute ago. The dust had kicked up still hung in the air above the Miranshah Boya Highway. Sam rubbed his eyes for a moment and then looked back. Instantly, he pushed his face tighter into the eye cup of the optic. There, on the road below him, four darkened pickup trucks had pulled to a stop, and men rolled out of the back of the beds. They carried rifles, their clothing was black, and they moved stealthily up the rocky hillside, directly toward the ISI safe house.
"We're getting hit," shouted Driscoll.
Mohammed was at his side with his radio in his hand a moment later. He used his binoculars, saw the dozen or so men down 100 yards below them, and turned to one of his captains.
"Contact the base. Tell them we need a priority exfiltration now."
His subordinate headed for his radio, and al-Darkour turned back to Driscoll.
"If we take the trucks, they will destroy us with those RPGs on the road."
But Sam was not listening. He was thinking.
"Mohammed, why would they assault like that?"
"What do you mean?"
"They have to know we are watching the road. Why did they go to the road, the low ground, and not the high ground behind us?"
Al-Darkour thought about it, but only for a moment.
"We are already surrounded."
"Exactly. That's a blocking force below us. The attack will come from..."
An explosion rocked the rear wall of the compound. It was 30 yards from where al-Darkour and Driscoll stood in the hallway, but still it knocked them to the ground. The ISI major began shouting commands into his radio, and he climbed back to his feet. Sam grabbed his M4 and ran toward the stairs, took them three at a time as he rushed to meet the enemy who would be trying to breach the rear wall. Sam hit the ground floor and kept running for the back of the building. He passed two 7th Commando men in a room on his left. They trained the lights of their weapons out a ground floor window, blanketing the eastern portion of the compound with white light, desperate to find targets. Driscoll continued toward the exit to the rear grounds and hoped like hell the sentries posted at the back gate were still in the fight, keeping Haqqani's men pinned down in the surrounding brush and hills. Chattering gunfire came from the front of the safe house as the enemy moved through the rocks up the hill toward the front entrance. As Sam ran full speed toward the open rear door, preparing to shoot across the pitch-black grounds toward the gate, al-Darkour came over the speaker of Sam's walkie-talkie. He spoke English now.
"Sam, our rear wall sentries are not checking in. The enemy must already be inside the compound."
Driscoll's momentum took him through the doorway as he processed this information. He'd not made it 5 feet out into the night when bright flashes of light flickered from the gate 20 meters ahead, and booming Kalashnikov fire echoed off the outer walls of the house. Driscoll stumbled in the dust, turned, and retreated back to the doorway in a crouch. The door frame tore to splinters from the Haqqani fighters' rounds, but Sam managed to get back inside and up the hall without taking a bullet. Al-Darkour met him there. He was still shouting into his walkie-talkie. Both men leaned back around the corner and fired a few rounds out into the dark night. Neither thought he could quell the attack with a couple of bursts of an assault rifle, but they did hold out hopes of making some impression on anyone who thought they could just rush in the open back door and make their way up the hall unimpeded. Al-Darkour shouted into Sam's ear after firing a few more bursts in the narrow hallway.
"I've called for a helicopter from the base in Miranshah, but the quick reaction force will not be ready for 15 minutes.
"Not quick enough," said Sam as he dropped to his knees, leaned around the corner, and shot out the lights of the hall.
"It will be 30 minutes or more before they arrive."
Driscoll released the empty magazine from the magazine well of his rifle, then replaced it with a fully charged mag from his chest rig. Incoming gunfire from all sides had picked up now, and shouts over the comms, even though Driscoll could not understand the words, gave the impression that the building itself was about to be overrun.
From the sound of it, we don't have anything like 30 minutes. How many men do you have left?
Al-Darkur got back on the walkie-talkie to find out, while Driscoll went prone at the corner of the hall, then slowly rolled out on his right shoulder, putting him low in the hallway toward the back door, with his weapons barrel scanning for threats. He could not see a thing in the dark, so he actuated his weapon light on the side rail of the M4. Instantly, 200 lumens of bright white light filled the hallway, illuminating two Haqqani fighters making their way silently toward Sam's position. They were blinded by the beam, but they raised their weapons anyway. Driscoll pulled the trigger on his M4 rifle, swept a dozen rounds of automatic fire back and forth across the two men. They died before either of them got a shot off. More sparkles of gunfire from the dark night outside forced Sam back around the corner, where he reloaded again.
"I have 6 men alive," Muhammad said.
Sam nodded as he reloaded.
"All right. Any chance we can make it to the trucks in the garage on the east side?"
"We have to try, but the road will be covered with Haqqani's men."
"Who needs a road?"
Driscoll grabbed a fragmentation grenade from his chest harness, pulled the pin, and then flung it underhanded up the hallway like a tiny bowling ball. Muhammad Al-Darkur and Sam Driscoll took off toward the men fighting at the east window as the explosion tore through the doorway. 2 minutes later, a group of 8 Haqqani fighters attacking from below had made it through the gate and up the drive on the southeast side of the compound. They'd left 4 of their number behind, 1 dead, felled by a shot through the stomach from a second-floor window of the enemy safe house, and 3 more wounded, 1 by gunfire and 2 by a hand grenade tossed down the hill by a sentry at the gate who had himself been shot dead 1 second later. But now the 8 survivors were within 20 meters of the garage. The door was open and it was dark inside, so the men approached quietly and slowly while their comrades fired into the building on the other sides. If they could make it into the building from the door here in the garage, they could, by staying low to avoid fire from their own forces, comb through the structure and destroy any remaining forces there. As the men came to within 10 yards of the garage entrance, their leader was just able to make out 2 large trucks parked inside. His night vision had been all but ruined by his firing several magazines from his Kalashnikov, so as he moved forward now, he had to squint to hunt for a door inside. All 8 men passed the 2 trucks, found the door giving them access to the building, and they went inside in a line, crouching and listening for threats. As soon as the 8 Haqqani men disappeared from the garage, Sam Driscoll, Muhammad Al-Darkur, 2 ISI officers, and 4 Zarar commandos quietly climbed out from under the truck farthest from the door. A driver, Al-Darkur, and 3 others climbed in the front of the vehicle, while Sam and 2 others remained at the back of the garage. Once Sam heard the driver quietly release the handbrake, he and 2 men pushed the truck from behind with all their might. The nose of the vehicle was already oriented downhill, so once they had pushed the truck out of the garage, it began to pick up speed quickly. Sam and the 2 men gave 1 more firm shove, then leapt into the back of the covered bed. The driver did not turn over the engine, nor did he turn on the headlights. The only sound made by the dark vehicle was the crunching on the rocky driveway as it moved faster and faster down the hill. The driver had only a very faint light from the overcast sky to guide him toward the front gate, and if he missed it a few feet right or left, the truck would plow into the wall and they would then have to fire the engine, letting everyone still on the hillside or on the road below know exactly where they were. But the driver made it through the gate. The truck rolled faster now, and the driver had to force the wheels to turn left and right by using all of his upper body strength. It was still 100 yards of steep, winding gravel to the road below, and the pathway twisted and turned all the way down. They made it out of the compound itself, which was where the majority of the enemy guns had concentrated by now. But someone on the hillside either heard or saw the truck when it was only 20 yards outside the gate. A shout, then a series of shouts, and then finally erupting gunfire put an end to the stealthy part of Sam Driscoll's plan. He shouted from the back of the vehicle to the driver, told him to forget about trying to stay on the gravel road. Now it was all about getting away from the guns as fast as possible, no matter where the truck ended up or what condition it was in when it got there. The driver went off-road, used his big heavy truck's momentum to propel him and his passengers down through the dark. There were Haqqani men on all sides of the hurtling object, but most of them were unable to fire without hitting their fellow militants. A few men did fire, and Sam's position in the back of the truck was raked with 7.62 rounds. One man with him was shot through the head. Another took 2 rounds in his left bicep and left shoulder, and Sam took a round high on his protective steel sappy, small arms protective insert plate in his chest rig vest. The impact knocked him over, down to the floor, just as the huge covered truck slammed hard on a large boulder and went airborne several feet. The nearly decapitated Zarar soldier's body rolled with Sam in the rear of the vehicle. The truck continued, careening down the hillside. It bounced again and again, and the driver had to focus all of his faculties on keeping the truck pointed downhill so that it would not veer sideways and flip. They were only 20 yards or so to the road when Muhammad saw more Haqqani Network fighters step out of the darkness and open fire on the hurtling truck. One man held an RPG. There was no way to engage him from the middle of the cab of the truck. It would have been impossible even if they weren't being battered and jolted in all directions from the roll down the rocky hillside, but as it was, there was no point even attempting to point a gun at the man. Instead, he shouted into the back,
Sam, RPG right side, 20 meters.
Got it. Muhammad al-Darkur could not see the American behind him, so he had no way of knowing that Driscoll hefted his M4, stood in the covered bed, and held on to a roll bar. As the vehicle hit the main road and swerved hard to the left to avoid a parked Haqqani pickup, Sam swung outside of the rear of the vehicle, one-handed his rifle up the road, and dumped a full 30-round magazine at any and all movement he saw out in the dark. A rocket-propelled grenade ignited and streaked in his direction, but the glowing warhead shot harmlessly high up in the night sky. Machine gun fire from the other side of the road clanged against the metal parts of the big truck as it turned toward the east and headed back to Miran Shah. Sam tried to get back inside the truck to make himself as small a target as possible. His feet slipped, and he found himself hanging onto the roll bar, holding the canvas wall of the truck. He let go of his rifle to take the bar with both hands, and his weapon hung from its sling around his neck. While he fought to get his boots back in the vehicle, the one surviving commando in the back with him fired his M4 up the hillside from where they had just come. Return fire from the enemy flickered like fireflies off the rocky hill. Just then, in the cab of the vehicle, a long stream of 7.62mm tracer rounds tore through the windshield, shattering the glass from the major's left to his right. Burning bullets slammed into the chest plate of the ISI captain on al-Darkur's left, then clanged off of the steel on his own body armor, and then finally raked across the neck of the driver. The man did not die instantly, though. With a gurgle and a hiss of air, he grabbed his neck wound and writhed in pain. The big truck immediately veered to the right with these movements and ran off the road, bouncing down the hill again toward the dry riverbed below. Sam had gotten both feet just inside the truck bed when the vehicle jacked to the right and went airborne before once again starting a violent high-speed descent. The movement spun Sam sideways, threw him hard against the side of the vehicle, and then he lost his grip on the metal bar. The American fell off the truck just 20 yards or so from the road, and the big vehicle continued on down the hill. 37. Muhammad al-Darkur did his best to control the hurtling truck by reaching over the dead driver and grabbing the steering wheel. It was easier said than done, as Muhammad's helmet had come off, and now, each and every bump the tires rolled over below him sent his head straight up into the metal ceiling of the cab. He felt blood dripping down his face, but he could not wipe it away before it filled his eyes because he needed both hands on the steering wheel. Finally, they leveled out at the bottom of the dry riverbed. He'd even managed to turn the wheel enough to keep them out of the majority of the limestone rocks that had collected there through thousands of rainy seasons. He could still hear gunfire in the distance, but he took the time to get a foot over on the brake, and then wait for his captain to leave the left side of the truck and, while under fire from above, climb in on the right, pushing the dead man into the middle seat. The captain took the wheel now, and al-Darkur scooted to the left window, found his rifle on the floorboard of the truck, and fired at the flashes of light up on the hill as the truck raced off to the east. Al-Darkur was keenly aware that he did not hear any of the men in the back of the truck shooting. He worried about his men, and he worried about the American who he had promised to protect with his life. But there would be no going back. They had to make it to the base on their own, and only then could they do anything to help the wounded or anyone left behind. Sam awoke slowly. His body was rolled in a heap and lying next to a small boulder. He did not feel any immediate pain, but he'd been around long enough to know that he was most definitely injured. The tumble out of a truck moving at that speed would have hurt him, whether or not the adrenaline pumping through his bloodstream right now would mask it. He remained still where he lay, and he watched the big truck continue off down the hillside. Men above him on the road fired down on it. They had not yet seen Driscoll, and he hoped he could lie here in the dark for now, wait for the Haqqani men to leave, and then sit up and assess his injuries. Above him on the road, the gunfire died down as the truck raced away and disappeared up the dry riverbed. He heard men climb into trucks and drive off, and he heard other men, Haqqani fighters most likely, moaning in pain. He had no idea how many survivors were on the hill above him, but he had no doubts that the area up around the compound, higher on the hill from the road, would still have able-bodied enemy shooters. Driscoll's hands moved over his body now. He felt blood on his arms and on his face, but he was able to move without pain. He then lifted his legs slowly, one at a time, and found them operational. He reached out into the dry dirt and brush, searching with his fingertips for his rifle, but the weapon had come off his body when he fell off the truck. His pistol was still on his hip, however. He knew this because the weapon was digging into his lower ribs. Once reasonably certain that he was ambulatory, he looked around him in the dark. A low copse of trees lay 50 yards farther down the hill to the west, and he thought he might try and low crawl there to find cover before daylight. Just then, from the road above, a flashlight's beam illuminated the trees. Another beam tracked to the east, to Driscoll's left. The lights searched the hillside haphazardly, searching perhaps for anyone who'd fallen from the escaping truck. Sam did not move. There wasn't much he could do but hope the beam didn't settle on him as he lay there. If nothing else, he wanted his hand on the grip of his Glock 17 pistol. But even accomplishing that small feat would involve more movement than he was prepared to make. The lights passed over him, and then stopped on a point on the hill to his left and another 20 yards on. Men on the road began shouting now. There was no question but that they had seen something. Shit, thought Sam. If the Haqqani shooters started heading down the hill, he would have no choice but to... And then, movement right where the flashlight beams had settled. A lone SSG commando, the man who had been in the back of the truck with Driscoll when it ran off the road, stood up and opened fire with his M16. He must have been tossed out as well, but he'd now been spotted. He knew it, and he had no choice but to go loud. Driscoll saw that the man was wounded. Blood covered his clothing and gear and shone in the white light beams centered on him. Sam could have stayed right where he was, but he did not even consider it. He rolled up to his knees, drew his Glock 9mm pistol, and opened fire on the men above. By doing this, he knew he was risking the chance that the Zarar soldier would shoot him in the back in surprise at the sudden movement and noise. But he decided to put his trust in the training and instincts of the commando, and concentrate on killing as many of the Haqqani forces as possible. With his pistol, he dropped both of the men holding flashlights, hitting one in the thigh and the other center mass. Others on the road dove for cover, giving Driscoll a second to turn toward his colleague in the SSG. "Hit for those trees 10 yards at a time," he shouted, and the young soldier looked back over his shoulder, found the cops halfway down the hill, and then turned and ran back 10 yards. While he did this, Sam fired a few pistol shots up the hill. Then, when the SSG man laid down suppressive fire, Driscoll leapt to his feet and began running down toward the trees himself. They moved in a leapfrog fashion, bounding 10 yards, then providing supporting fire for the other as they hurried for the relative cover of the trees below them. More than once, either Sam or the SSG sergeant fell during his descent, slowing the process and giving the men above a near stationary target at which to shoot. They made it to within 20 yards of the trees when the slide of Driscoll's Glock locked open after firing the last round. The Zarar commando was bounding past him at just that instant. Sam pulled his last full pistol mag from his belt and slammed it into the gun's grip and then dropped the slide chambering around. Next to him, he heard the soldier grunt loudly, then the man pitched forward and tumbled to the ground. The American fired 7 rounds up toward the road, then spun and ran to help his wounded comrade. He dropped to the ground next to the commando's still form, and he found the back of the soldier's head completely sheared away by a well-placed AK round. The man had died instantly. Fuck! Sam shouted in frustration and anguish, but he could not stay here. The sparks kicked up by impacting jacketed bullets in the rocks around him encouraged him to move his ass. Driscoll grabbed the rifle off the dead man and then crawled, rolled, and slid the rest of the way to the trees. The Haqqani network fighters wasted no time in targeting the woods where Driscoll had sought cover. Kalashnikov rounds tore into the trunks and limbs of the mulberry and fir and sent leaves and needles raining down like heavy mountain snowfall. This forced Sam to drop down onto his belly and crawl as fast as possible to the other side of the little copse. It was only 30 yards across and 30 yards deep, so he knew he could not hide out here for long. Sam found a spot behind a thick tree trunk, and he took a moment to check his body for injuries. He was slick with blood. Certainly he'd caught shrapnel from kicked-up rocks on the hillside, and cuts from head to toe falling out of the truck and rolling down to his current cover. He also checked his gear. or what was left of it. The rifle he had confiscated from the dead soldier was an older M16. A good gun with a nice long barrel, great for hitting targets at distance, though he would have preferred his scoped M4 lost up on the hillside. His three remaining M4 mags in his chest rig would work in the M16, and for this he was grateful. He reloaded his new rifle with an old magazine, and then he moved to another position, this one right at the southern edge of the grove. Here he thought over his options. He could surrender, he could run, or he could fight. He did not consider surrender for a moment, which left two options, run or fight. Driscoll was a brave man, but he was a pragmatist. He had no problem hauling ass, if that was his best option for survival at this point. He peered out of the woods and checked to see if there was any escape route possible. A grenade, possibly fired from an RPG launcher, exploded 30 yards behind him. Fuck! He peered out across the valley now. A sliver of moon shone through a break in the clouds, casting a faint glow across the dry limestone riverbed that ran off to the east and west. The rock field was 50 yards wide at the floor of the valley, and anyone leaving the grove where he had sought cover would be exposed to the guns above him on the road for several minutes before he could find more cover. No way Sam was going to slip away into the night. He couldn't run down to the riverbank and try to run away. It would be suicide. Driscoll decided then and there that he wasn't going to go out with a bullet in the back. These trees would be his Alamo. He would face his enemy and fight them, make as many of them pay as he could before their sheer number did him in. Slowly, and with some reluctance, he hefted his M16, stood, and headed back up through the woods. He'd not made it 10 yards before chattering AK fire sent more leaves on top of him. He dropped down on his knees and fired blindly through the cover, dumped half a magazine downrange to put any heads down. Then he regained his feet and ran up, charging toward the enemy. A group of 6 Haqqani men had made it halfway down the hillside from the road. They'd been sent down by their leaders to search for the soldier, who would certainly be hiding under a rock in the trees. Sam knew he surprised them by breaking out of the trees in front of them, his rifle on his shoulder, and flames and smoke spewing from it. As they returned fire, along with a firing line of men on the road above, Driscoll dropped onto his heaving chest, sighted on the flashes of their Kalashnikovs, and fired 3 round bursts until his magazine ran dry. He knew he'd taken out at least 2 of the men, and 4 remained. So he rolled onto his hip, pulled a mag out of his chest harness, and began reloading his gun. Just then he saw a larger flash of light up on the roadside. Instantly, he recognized the wide flash of an RPG taking flight, and in another instant, he realized the missile was going to hit right where he lay. With no time to think, he vaulted to his boots, turned, and leapt back toward the trees. The grenade hit the ground just behind him, exploded in fire and light, and blew American operative Sam Driscoll end over end, sending hot, sharp shrapnel into his body and tossing him into the woods like a discarded rag doll. There he lay, face down and motionless, while the Haqqani descended on his position. 38. President Ed Kielty had spent virtually all of the past 2 weeks on the campaign trail. There were 5 swing states that Benton Thayer felt could go either way, so Kielty canvassed them in Air Force One. This morning he went to a church in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and then headed to a wind turbine plant for lunch and a quick tour. He then flew to Youngstown, Ohio for a rally before shooting east for a dinnertime black tie affair in Richmond, Virginia. It was after 10:30 in the evening when Kielty climbed out of Marine One on the White House's back lawn. On the short chopper flight over from Andrews Air Force Base, he'd been informed by his chief of staff, Wesley McMullen, that Benton Thayer needed to meet with him in the Oval Office. Thayer had also asked that Mike Brannigan be there. This was odd, the campaign manager requesting the Attorney General be present at a meeting, but Wes had everyone assembled and waiting on the president. Kielty shot straight into the office without going to the residence first. He still wore his tuxedo, having not changed out of it during the 20-minute flight from Richmond.
"Can we make this quick, guys? It's been a long day."
Thayer sat on one of the 2 sofas. Wes McMullen sat next to him, and Brannigan sat across, next to Kielty. The campaign manager got right down to it.
"Mr. President, something came into my possession today. A computer drive. It was left on my car at my club. I have no idea who gave it to me or why I was chosen." "What is on it?"
"It is a dossier on a retired Navy SEAL and CIA paramilitary operations officer named John Clark. He is a recipient of the Medal of Honor."
"I'm bored already, Benton."
"You won't be bored for long, Mr. President.
Clark is a close personal friend of Jack Ryan's. They work together on certain operations. Certain black ops-type missions. Keelty leaned forward.
Go on.
Someone has plopped a computer drive into our labs that contains evidence of criminal wrongdoing by this Mr. Clark. Assassinations for the CIA.
Keelty nodded. Assassinations?
As well as wiretaps, breaking and entering, etc., etc.
This file comes from someone at CIA?
It doesn't look like it. The drive does have information from CIA sources, that's for damn sure. There must be a leak over there. But this information looks like it might be coming from China or Russia, or even a friendly government that doesn't want Ryan back in the saddle over here.
Keelty nodded, looked at Brannigan.
The AG was hearing about this for the first time. He had a look on his face like he knew he had a long night ahead of him checking all this out.
Thayer continued. But all this stuff Ryan's buddy Clark did, every murder, every breaking and entering, every illegal wiretap, it is all inadmissible in court.
And why is that?
Because several years ago, President Ryan gave him a full pardon for each and every act he did while working for the CIA.
Keelty smiled as he stood up slowly.
He didn't.
He did.
Some in the Justice Department know about it, but not many.
Keelty turned to Mike Brannigan.
Mike, tell me you didn't know.
I had no idea, sir. It must have been sealed.
Whoever has given us this information, if it is true, must have gotten the information illegally through.
Can he do it?
Keelty asked.
Was that legal, just waving a wand over a CIA black operator to say no harm, no foul?
Brannigan did speak up with some authority now.
A presidential pardon can clean your slate from most any federal crime.
Civil, state, and local charges aren't affected, although I assume with a CIA operator that wouldn't be a factor.
Keelty's chest heaved with excitement, but then he deflated.
Okay. So if Ryan gave this meathead a pardon, sure, we could leak it if we did it carefully.
That will be embarrassing for Ryan, but we won't be able to get to Clark. And without Clark in hand, up on charges, it won't be anything other than one-day news.
You know how Ryan is. He'll wrap himself up in the flag and salute the camera and say, I did what I had to do to keep your kids safe, or some bullshit like that.
Thayer shook his head. Ryan pardoned him for his actions with the CIA, but there is one murder in the file that, apparently, did not happen as part of his CIA duties. Thayer looked down to the pages in his lap. He supposedly killed an East German named Schumann, 1981, in Berlin. The file I have doesn't have a word on it. I checked other avenues as well. As far as the CIA is concerned, even internally, this never happened.
Keelty connected the dots.
So if he is off the hook for killings while working his CIA job, and this murder was not a CIA job,
Thayer said, then the full pardon is irrelevant.
Keelty looked at Brannigan.
Is that enough to pick him up on?
Mike Brannigan looked stunned.
Mr. President, I am only just hearing about this. I really need to get together with my staff, some key people at FBI, and look over any information you have on Clark. I can tell you DOJ is going to need to know that this information would be admissible in court before they will go any further. I mean, who the hell is this source?
Keelty looked at the Attorney General.
If you can corroborate information in Benton's file through CIA or other sources, then you won't need Benton's file anymore. The source becomes a non-issue. It's just a nudge in the right direction.
Mr. President, and Mike, I know you will do the right thing.
Wes McMullen, the chief of staff, had been silent throughout the conversation, but now he leaned in.
Isn't there a law that says we can't out a CIA agent?
There were shrugs around the room, then all heads turned to Brannigan again.
I believe that is for active employees. If we know, and I mean 100% know, that this guy is out of the intelligence services, then he's fair game.
Keelty looked relieved by this, but McMullen still had reservations.
I'm worried this is going to look like sort of a lame Hail Mary, like us digging up some 30-year-old murder to try and pin tangentially on Jack Ryan here with just a few days until the election. I mean, really?
Keelty said,
It's not a Hail Mary. The information was dumped in our laps. I will stress this and I will ask the question. If this was handed to us and we did nothing, how would that look? We came into this term promising to right the wrongs of the Ryan years, and boys and girls, I am still the President of the United States.
Wes McMullen tried another approach to put his toothpaste back in the tube.
Clark has a Congressional Medal of Honor. They don't just hand those out in a box of Cracker Jacks, sir.
So, big fucking deal. We throw in a line about how while we honor his military service, we cannot condone acts of murder, blah, blah, blah. I'll mention that I am the goddamn commander-in-chief, for Christ's sakes. Stop fighting me on this, Wes. I'm going forward. Mike, I need cover to do so.
Brannigan gave an unsure nod. If we can get some bit of corroboration from CIA, anything, really, then I'll be able to at least bring the man in for questioning.
Keelty nodded.
I'll talk to Kilbourne at CIA and tell him Justice Department investigators want to talk to everyone who worked with this John Clark.
Thayer said, if we can get this to stick to Clark, it will affect Ryan, as it pushes the narrative that he acts above the law.
Keelty was standing and pacing now over by his desk.
Fuck yes, this will affect Ryan. This needs to come out in the next 24 hours so that I can use it on my last swing through the Rust Belt. I can ask the crowd if a President Ryan would just whack the President of Mexico the next time he doesn't get his way on a trade issue.
It speaks to his past. It speaks to his present insofar as he's supposedly so strong on foreign affairs. But are you really strong on foreign affairs if you have to resort to sending out your goon squad to kill others and then cover it up with a secret pardon?
Keelty was nearly breathless, but he thought of something else and spun in his patent leather shoes to the three men on the sofas.
And it speaks to the future of this country if we allow a man who works with and cavorts with a bloodthirsty killer like this John Clark to take over the Oval Office.
Keelty looked to his chief of staff.
Wes, I'm going to need that line. Write that down and hang on to it.
Of course.
Okay, gentlemen. Anything else?
Thayer said, Clark has a partner. He was mentioned several times in the file. He is tight with Ryan as well.
Does this guy have a full pardon?
I don't know.
Okay, let's get to work on him too.
He saw a look of reticence in Thayer's eyes.
No? Why not?
Domingo Chavez is the guy's name. He's Mexican-American.
Shit,
Keelty said, thinking it over.
There goes fucking Arizona and New Mexico. Won't affect Texas. I didn't have a prayer there.
He gasped.
California?
Thayer shook his head. You could carpet bomb Mexico City with B-52s and you won't lose California to Jack fucking Ryan. Still, you will lose a shitload of Hispanic votes all over the country if the FBI goes after a guy named Chavez.
Okay.
The political wheels in Keelty's head turned.
Bury the Mexico angle on the Ryan story. Let's go after Clark and Clark alone.
Everyone agreed.
All right. Mike, you go to Kilbourne for access to CIA personnel. But Wes, I want you to get Deputy Director Alden over here tomorrow, first thing.
I want to see if he knows anything about John Clark. Alden is a suck-up. He'll play ball with me in a way Kilbourne won't.
39. Melanie Kraft did not mind working late in the operations center of the National Counterterrorism Center. Her work consumed her, especially after she'd been handed a project by her boss, Mary Pat Foley, the week before. Mary Pat had tasked her with learning everything she could about a brigadier general in Pakistan's ISI named Riaz Rehan. A curious tip to CIA from a one-time-use overseas email address implicated the general as a former operative in both Lashkar-e-Taiba and Jaish-e-Mohammed. This was interesting, but NCTC needed to know what Rehan was up to now. Melanie had worked the question from several different angles, and she'd struck out several times a day in the past week. But she'd been working the Rehan question all day, and she felt like she had something to show for it. It was after midnight when she thought she had enough to go to the assistant director, and she knew Mary Pat was still in her office. She tapped on the office door, softly and somewhat reluctantly.
Come in.
Melanie entered, and Mary Pat's tired eyes widened.
Dear Lord, girl, if you look that tired at your age, I must look like the walking dead.
I'm sorry to bother you. I know better than to troubleshoot theories with the boss, but my brain is fried and there isn't anyone else to bounce this off of.
I'm glad you popped in. Want to go grab a coffee?
A minute later, they were down in the cafeteria, spinning stir sticks and hot coffee. Mary Pat said,
Whatever you have has got to be more stimulating than what I'm working on. DHS is asking me to help with a report for Congress. I'd rather be doing something substantive, but you kids get to do all the fun stuff.
I'm working on Rehan and his department at ISI.
Joint Intel Miscellaneous, right? Mary Pat asked.
Yes. A misleading name for the division that runs all Pakistan's foreign spies and liaises with all the terrorists around the world.
A lot of sneaky people work in government around the world, Foley said. It's not below them to hide something nefarious behind bureaucratic speak.
Melanie nodded. From what I can tell of Rehan's organization, his department's operational tempo has been through the roof in the past month.
Impress me with what you found out.
The general himself is such a cipher, I decided to dig into his organization a little more, maybe find something that can lead to an understanding of what they are doing.
What did you find?
A 30-year-old Pakistani was arrested 2 months ago in New York. He got in a fight buying a knockoff watch in Chinatown. In his possession, NYPD found $12,000 and 13 prepaid Visa cards totaling $37,000 and a debit card for a checking account in Dubai. Apparently, this guy was withdrawing cash with his debit card and then going to bodegas and drugstores and using the cash to buy the prepaid cards. A couple here, a couple there, so as not to attract attention.
Interesting, Mary Pat said as she sipped her milky coffee.
He was deported immediately, without much of an investigation. But I've been looking into the guy, and I think he was J.I.M.
Why?
A, he fits the mold. Heavy Islamic family ties to the Fatah. He served in a traditionally Islamist unit in the PDF, and then left that unit going into reserve duty. That's common for ISI employees.
B, Mary Pat asked,
not exactly sold on the circumstantial nature of Melanie's inference.
B, the Dubai account. It's registered to a shell corporation in Abu Dhabi that we've tied to contributions to Islamist players in the past.
A slush fund?
Right. The shell corporation has some transactions in Islamabad, and the bank itself has been used by different groups. Lashkar men in Delhi, Haqqani men in Kabul, Jamaat ul Mujahideen in Chittagong.
Is there another shoe still to drop here?
I'm hoping you will tell me. Melanie hesitated, then said, Riaz Rehan, we have determined, was the man known as Khalid Mir. Mir is a Lashkar-e-Taiba operative.
Right.
Well, Lashkar men working in India on missions that have been linked to Khalid Mir had been known to use prepaid Visa cards bought with cash in New York.
Mary Pat nodded. I think I remember reading that in the past.
And Riaz Rehan was also known as Abu Kashmiri, a known high-level operative for Jaish-e-Mohammed.
Yes.
Well, a three-man Jaish-e-Mohammed cell that was killed after an ambush in Kabul was found to be using prepaid visas purchased in New York.
Mary Pat shook her head.
Melanie, lots of terrorist organizations have been using these prepaid cards in the past years. It is the easiest way to move money without leaving a financial trail. And we've picked up other shady Middle Eastern characters in New York with loads of cash on trips to buy prepaid cards, presumably to pass them out to others to create an untraceable conduit of operating funds.
Well, that's my point exactly. The other people who have been picked up and deported, what if they were working for Rehan as well?
The ones we were able to tie down had no known association with J.I.M.
Neither did Khalid Mir or Abu Kashmiri. I'm just saying, if Rehan uses this M.O., then the same method of operation might mean the same man is behind it. I am starting to think Rehan has more identities than the ones we know about.
Mary Pat Foley looked at Melanie Kraft a long time before speaking, as if she was trying to decide if she should. Finally, she said,
For the past 15 years there had been rumors, just little whispers here and there that there was one unknown operative, a freelancer, who was behind all of the lower-level attacks.
Melanie asked, What do you mean, all of them?
Lots.
An incredible amount.
Some of our forensic guys over at Langley would point to little pieces of trade craft that were used across all the operations. Everyone started using Dubai accounts around the same time. Everybody started using steganography around the same time. Everybody started using prepaid phone cards around the same time. Internet phones as well.
Melanie continued to look incredulous.
Playing the devil's advocate, it's not uncommon at all to find similar trade craft in operations from unconnected groups. They learn from each other's ops. They pass field manuals around Pakistan. They get advice from ISI. Plus, when they do evolve individually, it is at a similar pace, using technology that they can get their hands on. It just stands to reason that, for example, all the groups started using long-distance phone cards around the time they became popular, or thumb drives when they became cheap enough. I don't buy this ghost story.
You're right to be skeptical. It was an exciting theory that explained things the easy way. Without any more work than saying, Forrest Gump probably did it.
Melanie laughed.
His code name was Forrest Gump?
Unofficial. He never got an official designation. But he was a character who showed up everywhere something happened. The name seemed to fit. And remember, some of these groups I am talking about had nothing to do with one another. But some at the agency were convinced there was one common thread running through them all. One coordinator of operations. Like they were all managed, or advised at least, by the same individual.
Are you saying Riaz Rehan might be Forrest Gump?
Mary Pat shrugged, drained the rest of her coffee. A couple months ago, he was just another low-level general running an office in the ISI. Since then, we've learned a lot about him, and it's all bad. Keep digging.
Yes, ma'am, said Melanie, and she stood to return to her desk.
But not tonight. Get out of here. Go home and get some sleep. Or better yet, call Junior. Have him take you to a very late dinner.
Melanie smiled, looked down at the floor.
He called today. We're getting together tomorrow.
Mary Pat Bowie smiled. 40. John Clark was new to trout fishing, and he recognized he had a lot to learn about it. On a couple of occasions, he'd managed to catch a few rainbow and brown trout in his neighbor's creek, though the streams and brooks on his own farm had so far yielded him nothing but frustration. His neighbor had told him there was good trout to be caught on Clark's own property, but another local contradicted that, explaining that what were called trout in the little streams like those on Clark's farm were actually just creek chubs, a member of the minnow family that grew up to a foot in length and could be feisty enough when on the line to fool amateur anglers into thinking they were battling a trout. John figured he'd get a book on fishing and read it when he had the time, but for this afternoon, he just stood out here alone in his waders in his neighbor's creek, whipped his line back and forth, dumped the fly in a slow-moving pool, and then repeated that process over and over and over. It looked a lot like fly fishing, except for the fact that he hadn't caught a damn thing. John gave up for the afternoon and pulled his line in an hour before dark. Though he hadn't managed to fool any fish into biting his fly, it had been a good day nonetheless. His gunshot wound had all but healed. He'd gotten a few hours of fresh air in solitude, and, before his afternoon of relaxation, he'd put a first coat of paint on the master bedroom of the farmhouse. One more coat this coming weekend, and he'd bring Sandy out so he could get a thumbs up from her to begin painting the living room. On top of that, he'd neither been shot again, nor had he found it necessary to kill anyone or run for his life. Yeah, a good day. John packed up his fishing gear, looked up to a gray sky, and wondered if this was what retirement felt like. He lifted his tackle box and his fly rod, and shook off the thought like he shook off the cold breeze rolling down from Catoctin Mountain to the west. It was a good half-hour's slog through the woods back to his farmhouse. He started the hike to the east by climbing the stones out of the creek up to an overgrown trail. John's farm was in Frederick County, west of Emmitsburg and within a mile of the Pennsylvania state line. He and Sandy had been looking for rural property since they returned from the UK, and when a Navy buddy who'd retired to a small dairy farm up here to make cheese with his wife told John about a for sale sign in front of a simple farmhouse on 50 acres, John and Sandy came up for a look. The price was right because the house needed some work, and Sandy loved the old house in the countryside, so they'd signed the contracts late last spring. Since then, John had been too busy at the campus to do much more than drive up during a rare free day off to work on the house and to do a little maintenance and fishing. Sandy came up with him now and again. Together they'd visited Gettysburg just a few miles up the road, and they hoped to get away soon for a weekend trip to Amish country in nearby Lancaster County. And when they retired, they planned to move up here full time. Or when Sandy retired, Clark reminded himself, as he pushed his way up a thick copse of evergreen brush that covered the hill leading away from the tiny stream. John had bought the property for their golden years, but he had no illusions that he would be one to just fade off into the sunset. That he would live long enough to retire and make cheese until his body slowly crapped out on him from age. No. John Clark figured it would all end for him a lot more suddenly than that. The bullet through his arm was about the 50th close call of Clark's life. 6 inches inside its flight path, and that 9mm round would have gone right into a lung, and he'd have choked to death in his own blood before Ding and Dom could have carried him down to street level. Another 4 inches to the left, and it would have pierced his heart, and he would not have even made it out of the attic. A couple of feet higher, and the round would have nailed the back of his head, and he would have fallen dead, like Abdul bin Muhammad al-Qahtani had dropped in the elevator of the Hotel du Cerf. John was certain that, sooner or later, and John was running out of later, he'd die on a mission. When he was young, really young, he'd been a Navy SEAL in Vietnam working in MACV SOG, the Military Assistance Command Vietnam Studies and Observations Group. Clark, along with others in SOG, had lived within a hair's breadth of death for years. He'd had many close shaves. Bullets that whizzed by his face.
Explosions that sent lethal shrapnel into men within arm's reach. Helicopters that lifted 500 feet into the air before deciding that they did not feel like flying anymore that day. Back then, these brushes with death just pumped him full of adrenaline, made him so fucking ecstatic to be alive that he, like many others of his age and in his profession, began to live for the drug called danger. John ducked under the low limb of a young poplar as he walked, careful to keep his fly rod from snagging on the branches. He smiled a little, thinking about being 22. So long ago. The bullet that nearly dropped him dead on the Paris rooftop didn't exactly fill him with the same giddy thrills he'd felt as a young SEAL in Nam. Nor did it fill him with dread and fear. No, John wasn't going soft in his old age. More like fatalistic. The bullet in France and the farmhouse in Maryland had a lot in common. They both told John that, one way or another, there is an end to this crazy ride. John climbed over a split-rail section of the fence at the southwest corner of his property. Once on his own land, he hiked through a small wood of loblolly pine where the slope of a hill led down into a tiny valley, where a shallow creek wound from north to south near the fence line. He looked down at his watch and saw it was 4:15. He didn't have any cell phone coverage out here, so for the 3 hours that he'd been out for his impromptu fishing trip, he'd been off the grid. He wondered how many messages he'd had back on the landline at the house, and he thought back again to his past, fondly remembering a time before mobile phones, when he didn't feel guilty for a walk in the damn woods. Being alone here in the wilds of Maryland made him think of being alone in the bush in Southeast Asia. Yeah, it was a long time ago, but not so long if you'd been there, and Clark had damn well been there. The plants were different in the jungle, obviously, but the feel was the same. He'd always liked being out in nature. He'd sure gotten away from that in the last several years. Maybe once the op tempo at the campus died down to a reasonable level, then he could spend a little more time out here in his woods. He'd love to take his grandson fishing someday. Kids still liked stuff like that, didn't they? He stepped into his creek, felt his way forward through the knee-deep water, and found himself especially thankful that he'd worn his waders this afternoon. The water was ice cold, spring-fed, and deeper than usual. The current wasn't as fast moving as it often was, which is why he crossed here as opposed to 100 yards or so upstream, where large flat stones protruded just an inch or so out of the water across the width of the creek to make a natural, if slippery, bridge. But today, Clark had no problem crossing right through the center of the stream, and even wading through a deeper pool created by a limestone depression, he found the water not more than waist deep. John moved through the deepest part of the creek, stepped through a weed bed that sprang out of the limestone, and then he stopped. He noticed something shining in the water, reflecting the setting sun's rays like steel. What is that? There, surrounding a clump of grass poking out of the knee-deep water, was a shiny pinkish film. As the water flowed downstream, the pink film trailed in the direction of the current. Individual globules broke away from the rest of the form and floated on. Unlike many Vietnam veterans, Clark did not have flashbacks per se. He'd done so much in the intervening 40 years since Nam that his years in-country weren't any more traumatic than many of his later experiences. But right now, while looking at this viscous substance clinging to the grass, he thought back to Laos in 1970. There, with a team of Montagnard guerrillas, he had been crossing a stream not much deeper than this one under a primeval rainforest. He'd noticed black film trailing downstream by their crossing point, and upon inspection, he and the others determined it to be two-stroke engine oil. They then turned upstream and found a spur of the Ho Chi Minh Trail that led them behind a group of North Vietnamese Army regulars who'd lost a scooter in the heavy current while trying to cross the stream. They'd fished out the bike, but not before its oil leaked out into the water, ultimately giving them away. Clark and his team of Montagnard guerrillas had wiped out the enemy from behind. Looking at the oil in the creek in front of him, he couldn't help but think back to Laos. He reached out and put his fingers into the thin film of pink, then brought them to his nose. The unmistakable smell of gun oil filled his nostrils. He even thought he could determine the make. Yes, it was Break Free CLP, his own favorite brand. Immediately, Clark turned his head to look upstream. Hunters. He couldn't see them, but he had little doubt they had passed on the natural footbridge 100 yards north sometime in the past half hour or so. There were white-tailed deer and turkey all over his property, and at this time of the evening, the deer would be in abundance. But it wasn't deer season, and Clark's fence line was damn well posted. Whoever was on his property was breaking a multitude of laws. Clark walked on, crossed the rest of the stream, and then picked up the trail that led